Mr. Ginsburg.
May it please the court, I'm Doug Ginsburg with the Department of Justice. This case involves numerous jurisdictional defects and bars. Section 242G of the INA, lack of custody, national security, justiciability issues. But what is perhaps most stark here is what the petitioner lacks, and that is a visa and, critically, presence in the United States. The Supreme Court has made clear in the case of Johnson v. Eisentrager and U.S. v. Vertigo Urquidez that has emphatically rejected extraterritorial application of the Fifth Amendment. It has held in a number of cases that even when an alien's presence in the United States is unlawful, the alien might have due process rights. And in the case of Landon versus Placencia, it found presence through the doctrine of assimilation. Landon, of course, involved the case of a returning lawful permanent resident who was coming back to the United States after a brief visit, and it was a question of whether she had made an entry. There was a special exception, and still is a special exception for permanent residents who come abroad. They don't make entries in general, just like today. They don't have to apply for admission. The court in Landon said, well, even lawful permanent residents can have that issue of entry determined in an exclusion proceeding. They don't have to be treated identically. But the court was saying that lawful permanent residents are dealt with differently and found presence by assimilating the alien to the status of a continuously residing lawful resident who is physically present in the United States. This defendant lacks presence. And what he asks for here is an unprecedented expansion of this assimilation doctrine, which heretofore has only been applied in the case of lawful permanent residents. What then is he being assimilated to? Can't be like in Landon, to the status of a lawfully, continuously residing permanent resident. When he left here, he was out of status. He had a student visa, he graduated. So then what would the status be? Various courts have held with respect to adjustment of status applicants that even when they're here, when they apply for adjustment of status, they're assimilated to the status of being an initial entrant. So even when they're here, they're assimilated. The assimilation doctrine works kind of in reverse with respect to them. They're assimilated to the status of being at the port of entry. Well, the petitioner here is not out of port, even out of port of entry. He's not even in the country. The doctrine in Eisentrager and its emphatic rejection of the Fifth Amendment extraterritorial application applies in full force. The Supreme Court has made clear as recently as in the case of Kim versus DeMoore, aliens may be treated differently than citizens. That's just the law, and has been for most of this country's history. So it's not clear how he gets around that jurisdictional bar of not being present. It's not clear how he gets around Section 242G, which prevents the court from commencing the removal proceedings, which is what he wants here. And it's also not clear what the prejudice is that he has suffered in this case. In other cases where, for example, the alien has been unlawfully deported, the alien is inadmissible because of the fact that he was unlawfully deported. If he goes to a U.S. consulate, they'll say, well, you've been unlawfully deported, you're inadmissible. That's not the case here. The petitioner here can go to a U.S. consulate, he can apply for a visa. He has a remedy. He hasn't done that. He hasn't explained why he can't do that. That's the procedure. When aliens are abroad, they go, if they want to enter the United States, they need to go get permission, and that permission is granted in the form of a visa. You have to apply for it at a U.S. consulate. It's not establish any prejudice. His final theory is that he's entitled to a Section 240 hearing under the INA. Well, that kind of bypasses the jurisdictional defects. But, you know, those aside for a second, all of those jurisdictional defects aside, the INA clearly does not provide 240 hearings for aliens who are abroad. And a kind of an analogous situation was addressed in Landon versus Placencia, again, where the Supreme Court described that aliens present in the United States get deportation hearings. Aliens who are at the ports of entry don't. They get exclusion hearings. Well, in this case, he's not even at a port of entry, and so the INA provides for a different type of system. It provides for pre-inspection. You get inspection if you're at a port of entry, and if you're not even at a port of entry, you get pre-inspection. Congress made clear we don't want inadmissible aliens even getting to the port of entry where various types of rights and processes might attach. So these aliens are screened at the pre-inspection stations. That's what happened in this case. That's the procedure established under 235A. And that's what happened here. At that station, he had no travel document. He was therefore inadmissible, and he was barred from entry. Again, it's not clear what the violation of the INA is. It's not clear what the jurisdictional defect is, and it's not clear how you get the extraterritorial application of the Fifth Amendment, given that this alien is outside the borders of the United States. There's no questions. I'd reserve my time for.
Well, I just would ask you whether there's any language in the advance parole document, Mr. Ginsburg, which would have caused any sort of reliance by the appellant, the appellee, to view this 240 situation differently. I'm not questioning your jurisdictional argument at this point.
Okay.
But there is there not language in there that suggests a hearing to be had if you upon return?
No, there's not. The document makes it clear that the alien is going to have to establish his admissibility. Pre-inspection stations exist. If you can't establish your admissibility, you're going to get screened out at the pre-inspection station. The document certainly doesn't say this grant of advance parole shall never be revoked. It says very clearly, when you return, your status is changing. The fact of leaving the country has a legal effect.
Where are the locations of the pre-inspection stations?
Well, obviously there's one in Shannon Airport.
Is this a situation where if Mrs. Samara were to make an attempted return from another non-inspection port of deportation or place to fly to the United States, he wouldn't be presented with this?
Well, first of all, that's an issue which came up in the lower court, and I would to that say, well, the fact that an alien might have been lucky enough to embark from an airport without a pre-inspection station should not necessarily endow him with rights. He's not losing rights because he went to a pre-inspection station. He shouldn't gain rights by the fact that he came throughout. But also on the Mazai entrance, applicants for admission to the United States, even at ports of entry, don't have constitutional rights. But this case is...
I guess I'm just asking, if we flew to New York or Chicago, would the case be in any different posture than it is?
Well, if he flew from an airport without a pre-inspection station into JFK or wherever into the United States, he could have been put into a different type of proceeding, not necessarily a 240 proceeding. As we explained in the brief, there are other types of summary proceedings. Congress in the 96 Act created what they call Section 235B proceedings. So when aliens come into the United States without documents, then they can be summarily excluded. If they have a credible fear or a possible asylum claim, that's a possible difference. But barring that, they can be just turned around basically on the next plane. Extremely limited scope of habeas jurisdiction under Section 242E of the INA, limited to is he an alien and does he have his documents, basically. But that's it. So you don't get the opportunities to apply for adjustment or for cancellation or any of these other forms of relief. It's a summary expedited process, and that's what generally happens. They're done by the hundreds of thousands.
No, I appreciate that. I just want to get a sense of what the factual scenario is and why the choice is made to press forward in the posture by Mr. Samara that he does. I mean, but that's obviously a decision that's been made to seek relief based on the Shannon Act.
Right. And of course, from the government's perspective, that's why the pre-inspections exist. He went to an airport that had them.
Right.
And if he doesn't like the result, because he lacks a visa, he can go apply for one. It's as simple as that.
Thank you, Mr. Kinsberg. Mr. Fleshner?
May it please the court, Mr. Ginsberg. As you know, my name is Mark Fleshner. I'm with the law firm of Oldheimer & Gray, and the Midwest Immigration and Human Rights Center asked us to assist them in this case. What the government has failed to focus on is that this case really is about one thing, which is the jurisdictional issue. That was really the only thing that was at issue in the district court below, and while there was a lot of other stuff that has been thrown into the briefs on appeal, the only issue that the government even said to Judge Moran that they were interested in briefing down below was a jurisdictional issue because they claimed that there was no jurisdiction. And in fact, if that's the only issue that's before us, it seems to me that this court has already answered that question both in Ahmed and Adir recently, and that there is both mandamus jurisdiction you have held and that there is APA jurisdiction. Clearly, if this is not a non-frivolous facts which are presented to you, as you know, the case in Adir, and I think Ahmed, the facts are similar, which it was a diversity visa program in which the individuals won the lottery and applied for a visa. The INS failed to act on their applications within a timely period, and they then filed suit. This court held that there was both mandamus and APA jurisdiction. It's just that the people, the petitioners in those cases, did not file with the district court in a timely fashion because they had waited for the year to expire. So it seems to me that if the only issue, and it really is the only issue because it's the only issue that the government was concerned about below, and it's the only issue that really is before us is mandamus, or the jurisdictional issue, you have, and the district court, I should say, more importantly, had jurisdiction under mandamus and the APA. More importantly, even though I don't think you need to go this step, it's, of course, Dr. Samira's belief that there is habeas. There's jurisdiction pursuant to the writ of habeas corpus. The government argues that the petitioner, Dr. Samira's liberties, have not been restricted in any way. It seems to be really a rather ridiculous argument. He lives.
Is he held in some custody by an agency of the United States?
No, Judge Fong, but obviously you know that custody can be more than just detention. The Supreme Court.
Clearly, but he, what case would you say would be most analogous where there's freedom of movement, but yet a habeas claim could be allowed? That's right.
Well, we cited Jones versus Cunningham. This court has held that Hartz versus Indiana person does not have to be in prison to be in custody for habeas purposes.
Right.
The point is, however, that he is restricted from going to his home. He lives in Orland Park, Illinois. He has lived in Orland Park, Illinois for 15 years. He has three children who were born in the United States and go to school in Orland Park, Illinois. His wife, he had jobs in Orland Park, Illinois. It seems to me that it is irrelevant that he can go anywhere else in the world than his home. Clearly, if one of us were, the government were to tell one of us that we could go any place else in the United States except Chicago, where we happen to live and work, that would be a restriction on our liberty. And that's exactly what's happening here. Habeas corpus is available to an alien seeking entry into the United States, although he is free to go anywhere else in the world. That's what the Supreme Court held in Jones v. Cunningham. It seems to me, an odd comparison at best for the government to compare
Dr. Samira to the public. The public is not the population of the world outside the U.S. who has never been here. That's who they're trying to compare him to. In this case, it's people who have lived here and have lives here. That's who Dr. Samira is. The government also claims that the three reasons the government claims that the district court lacks jurisdiction is they claim that Dr. Samira is an alien abroad. He is not. They claim that the district court ordered removal proceedings. It did not. And they claim that there was a finding of admissibility in Shannon Island. There was none. Firstly, with respect to the fact that Dr. Samira is not an alien abroad. As I said, he's lived here for 15 years. Now, the issues about his legal and illegal status, of course, are not really before this court, nor they should be. There's a whole court system that's designed to determine whether or not Dr. Samira was in this country legally at one time or another. And that is not an Article III court. That is not you. It's not Judge Moran. The Article II judges have that responsibility to determine that. Of course, so the entire argument, the volumes of pages or of documents with respect to his legality or illegality in this country, in his presence, are really irrelevant for purposes of this proceeding. Although we still maintain that he was always in status while he was in this country.
Could Dr. Samir leave from a place other than Shannon and come here?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that, please?
Could Dr. Samir just go to another port or airport and come to this country without one that doesn't have the entry?
Could he have at the time, or can he now?
Can he now?
He cannot now because, of course, an airline would be prohibited from boarding him without appropriate travel documents. When his advanced parole was revoked by the government, that he is not able to board a plane for the United States. Had he not serendipitously boarded an airplane that was to stop at a pre-inspection station, he of course would have landed in the United States and been afforded the proper proceedings here in this country. Now there's a dispute as to what those proceedings should be.
Yeah, but what is the proceeding that the doctor seeks?
We don't seek any proceeding. Dr. Samira seeks to be returned to his status, as is the requirement under the statute when he is granted advance parole. That's what advance parole says. It defines, if you look at the regulations interpreting advance parole, 1.1Q defines an arriving alien for purposes of 235B1 not to include individuals who applied for or were granted advance parole before they left. That's true of 235C as well, that he is not an individual, he is not an alien outside the United States because he received advance parole prior to return or prior to leaving the United States. What he seeks is to return to his life. If there are issues, with respect to Dr. Samira's other activities, his political activities, if you will, there is a court system and there is a procedure, by the way, which the government has set up through the Act of Congress to deal with those issues. What the government has decided to do is they have decided to, well, we say he's guilty, and that seems to me to be a very, very dangerous step for the United States because it's in our whole system, this whole building. The government indicts someone in this building, and we have the whole court system to determine whether or not he is guilty, and that is exactly what the Article II judges are to determine. They've set up the system, and now they want to avoid that system. Even the limited rights that the system gives an individual like Dr. Samira, at least it gives him some rights. And those are the rights that that Dr. Samira is asking to be afforded to him. So we are not seeking, and it also seems to be a little bit odd for the government to suggest that we are. I'm sure Judge Moran is quite surprised to find out that that they are arguing that he has ordered removal proceedings because no one is asking for that. We're asking to go back to Orland Park, live his life, to raise his children, do his job, and to continue with his, by the way, 9-year application for adjustment of status.
Well, yeah, that is quite a long time. Were those applications to become a permanent resident? What were those during that time, Mr. Fletcher?
He has had three LPR applications, if you will. The first was denied. There's no question about that. That was applied in the early 90s. The second one, which is in dispute whether or not it's still pending, of course it is under the documents, it's still pending. That was applied for in 1995. Now we can argue and bicker whether or not the government just made a mistake by not denying it because of the application that I-360 was in fact denied. And then there's a third one that is pending that was applied for in 2001. A derivative application through the status of his wife's job here in this country. So there are two other applications which are still pending, and that's what he wants to do. He wants to go back, and I agree with you, and we can, I suppose, speculate, and you have written, your opinions have written much about perhaps the inefficiencies of the INS, but that really isn't the issue here. The question is, if
he wants to go back where?
He wants to go back to Orland Park.
Right, okay, right.
Did I answer your question, Judge?
Yes, yes. Okay. Thank you. Let me just ask you, looking at that advance parole document, do you think there's any language of reliance or estoppel that comes into play here? In other words, is there, Ms. Ginsburg feels there is nothing, but I'm just, when he received, the doctor received the document allowing the exits, not allowing, but speaking to the circumstances of the exit, I just wonder if there's anything in there that would impact how we should look at the case. That's all.
Well, clearly it is the system was set up to give him permission to leave and to return.
Right.
That clearly was his understanding, and of course that's the whole idea of why the system was designed.
Well, yeah, I guess the doctor arrives at Shannon on the date in question. What occurred at Shannon, was that anything he was not aware of? He spoke of it in a sort of serendipitous fashion. But I mean, where we find ourselves today, is that the product of any catch-22, any lack of notice? That's kind of my concern.
Sure, of course, that is the whole constitutional issue, that of course there's lack of notice. There was no notice given to his attorney. There was no notice given to him. There was no opportunity for him to respond. There was no hearing.
He knew he was going to a point where there would be this point of entry question, right?
Well, he knew, yes, of course, he knew he had to present his documents
right.
And go through the inspection, as he would have done had he landed in New York, had he landed in
right.
Shannon, had he landed anyplace else. The point is, the government's argument is that because he landed in Shannon, they can just turn him around and send him back. Of course, he was incarcerated overnight. But instead of had he landed in New York or Chicago, they would have had to give him the limited hearing that is available for him. Now, it, of course, again, this is not before the court, but it's our argument that a 235 B or C hearing is not applicable to him under their own regulations, that it would have to be a 240 hearing, that is to say, a full-blown hearing before an immigration judge, and perhaps we'll have an opportunity to test that at some point down the road. But the bottom line is, even though there is some limited process, there's limited process under any one of the three, depending on what is available to him. So, and it wasn't, according to the government, because, and that's where it's serendipitous, the serendipity of him getting on a plane that was going to stop in Shannon Island, as opposed to stopping at O'Hare or at Kennedy. And it seems to, I think it clearly struck Judge Moran as, that was, I think, when he used the gotcha phrase that the government...
I'm familiar with...
The gotcha phrase.
is it fair to characterize what the doctor is seeking as a reinstatement of his advance parole status?
It is Dr. Samir's position, it is our position, that this court, the advance parole is a discretionary granting. However, when the effect of revoking the advance parole is going to deny, the effect of that is going to deny him his due process rights and his statutory rights under the INA, then in fact, this court does have jurisdiction to review that decision.
Okay, because you would acknowledge 1252 speaks to revocation if that's the effect of what you think has occurred here, and that is pretty hard for the court to reach unless you get to this constitutional issue that you speak of, right? I mean, it is committed to the discretion of the Attorney General.
242G bars the review of that. That's absolutely right.
So, I mean, if in effect we've had a revocation, on the face of it, at least as a starting or ending point, depending on your position, that's not something the court could reach.
If he had a proper hearing under 240 and he was removed properly, that
you feel that's a predicate to the 1252 power of the Attorney General, that there has to be this 240 hearing?
No, Mike, in this case I do, yes. If the question is, does 242G prohibit the court from reviewing this decision to revoke the advance parole, the question is, the answer to that is, in the very limited circumstance in which the effect of that decision is going to deny the individual his constitutional due process rights, right to notice, right to be heard, and right to respond, then yes, you do have jurisdiction.
So your view is that Congress wanted the Article III courts to look at the panoply of potential rights that might attend an alien each time the Attorney General invoked revocation powers under 1252?
You
have a lot to do. And
you can see the line coming in the door. Obviously, this is a very, very narrow case, although it does have very broad implications because there are over a million people right now in the LPR or adjustment of status situation. But the narrow situation in which someone has obtained advance parole and leaves the country and that advance parole is revoked while he is out of the country, it's almost like one of my colleagues used the analogy of a fishing license. We give you a fishing license, you go out and catch 17 fish, you come back in and say, well, while you're out there catching the 17 fish, we revoked your license, so we're going to arrest you. That can't be the proper function of the government. Unless you have any other questions.
No, I didn't want to cut you off if you wanted to say. No, I didn't have any questions. No. Apparently not, but I didn't want to cut you off if you had another concluding remark.
We ask the court to properly affirm the district court. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Ginsburg.
Your Honor, there's certainly nothing in Section 212D5 of the INA, which is the parole statute, which places any restrictions on the ability of the Attorney General when revoking advance parole. In fact, advance parole is not even mentioned in the INA, and it's just kind of almost not even mentioned in the regulations. Parole is granted in the Attorney General's discretion for urgent humanitarian and public interest. For the same reasons, if those things don't exist, it can be revoked.
Is he entitled to a hearing before it can be revoked?
Well, there's certainly nothing in the statute or the regulations which require a hearing. It's discretionary,
Well, what happened to his 1995 application?
His 1995 application was predicated upon a petition, a religious workers petition, which was denied. Now, he filed an out-of-time motion to reconsider at some point, and therefore he says, well, that's still pending. But the fact was that's a dead letter application.
Your contention is that it isn't pending.
Excuse me?
That it is not pending.
That it is not pending.
Even though he filed his appeal. Has he ever been given any verification of that?
Well, the appeal was denied. He received notice of the appeal's denial, and that appeal, which is in the record, says this is the decision, and the record is being returned, from where it came. Right. And then he filed the late reconsideration application, which has no effect whatsoever on whether it's pending or not. But the government's position, it doesn't matter. That just makes him an adjustment
of adjustment of status application. That gives him no status or any particular rights, and he can pursue his visa application based on the same approved labor certification through his wife abroad at a U.S. consulate. So there's no estoppel argument made, because in any event, to get estoppel against the government, to the extent it's even possible, and that's an open question, you know, it requires affirmative misconduct. This is not estoppel against a private party. And no affirmative misconduct is alleged, and no estoppel is even alleged in this case.
Let me ask you, so I can, if I could, as important as this case is to the parties, I'm you know, every case we have arguably may be read by others for other cases down the road. Would this case, as you would have it, stand for the proposition that any alien in any status application, in any application for change of status today, who's in the country, who gets an advance parole document by leave of the Attorney General, and leaves the country, that it's pretty much unreviewable or unreviewable, that revocation power exercised by the Attorney General?
Well, the revocation.
Will we have that in this case? Will this case stand for that?
I think it would stand certainly for the proposition that revocations of parole are unreviewable. In fact, 236E, not just 242G.
So that any
simply says that.
Yeah. So any alien in this country, under the department's view, who applies for the advance parole status, gains it and leaves our shores, does so recognizing, no matter what their status has been to that point in the country, that if revoked by the Attorney General, there really is no Article III review of that. I'm just asking. I'm not suggesting that I've reached a conclusion on it, but I just want to make sure that that's where we're going.
Well, certainly on the facts of this case, that's the case. You know, whether in every possible case, I suppose if it was, you know, a lawful permanent resident, which has been the only exception recognized by the Supreme Court,
right.
And they did that again through the assimilation doctrine, finding presence. Presence is important, and you need to find presence somehow. And the petitioner
but
completely ignores that question of presence.
Dr. Samara cannot establish under our scenario presence for the purposes of.
And that's critical, and that's why I think some courts, even with respect to adjustment of status applicants, have assimilated them to the status of initial entrance. It's not the same as a permanent resident. When you're here on an F visa, a student visa, other non-immigrant visas, you are certifying. And the petitioner here certified in several places, I refer to exhibits E and F, that he is here temporarily. He says, I'm trying to return home. But he's certified to the U.S. government, and it was a term of his visa that he is here temporarily, in fact, and he is maintaining a permanent home abroad. Now, if he's saying, no, I'm permanent here, well, what are we establishing a constitutional doctrine upon? Upon a misrepresentation to the government. That's a grounds for deportation, not a grounds for constructing constitutional doctrine.
Thanks, Senator. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will proceed to the third case.